Hey, baby, Stevie Van Zandt here, and you are listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining us today in the Zoom room is this guy. I don't even know how to describe him. He's a singer, songwriter, producer, an actor, a guitarist. Please welcome little Stephen Van Zandt. How you doing, Stephen?
Pasquale, how are you?
I'm good. Now, I don't even know. I'm not quite sure what to call you because Miami Steve, little Stephen, little Stevie. What do people call you?
They call me Mr. Tibbs. They call me Stevie's fine. Stevie's fine.
Okay. So, first of all, so many things. Thank you for doing this, first of all. There's so many things I want to mention. You have a book coming out this year. And it's
called... end of September, it looks like, yeah.
Unrequited Infatuations. How long has the book been gestating in your head?
I tried it about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, and it just wasn't the right time. And I think this last 3 years of reconnecting with my life's work, you know, my music, which I kind of abandoned for a long time, hooking back up with it kind of gave me a little bit of closure. And, you know, I was able to at least figure out an ending for this chapter of my life anyway, you know, so... I really didn't do it until the quarantine. So it's mostly been done in this past year.
All right. So you've utilized your free time to do something productive. That's good. I know a lot of people are just sitting around watching Netflix, maybe watching Lilyhammer, but
nothing wrong with that.
I wanted to ask about Lilyhammer. In doing some research, you have a writing credit on every episode. So,
yeah.
No offense, were you really in the writer's room? Or did you come up with story ideas? What did little Steven do to get that writing credit?
The two creators, Ann and Eilif, and I worked for about a year before we shot it, figuring out all the plot lines and the characters and the basic premise, which was tricky, you know, how much English should there be in it? We were really one big experiment, which, you know, you got to give Netflix a lot of credit for making us their first show, man.
Yeah.
You know, a show with mostly subtitles, very ballsy thing to do. So we're trying to figure out, we wanted to make the Norwegian audience happy because it was a local Norwegian show.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, Eilif and Ann really wanted to have the first ever Norwegian international show, you know, and of course, that's what I wanted too. So we had we did a lot of guessing, you know.
Yeah.
I think success is basically 1,000 good guesses. And so that was the equivalent of the writer's room, if you will.
Right.
You know, there was no writer's room really. And then they wanted to do first drafts most of the time. I did first drafts on the last episodes of each season. Basically, they would write it, and I would rewrite some things and go back to them. We pass it back and forth, you know, because they wanted my dialogue to be realistic. So, you know, I probably wrote or rewrote most of what I said, what comes out of my mouth, you know, and other things too. You know, they did most of the first drafts, but we discussed every single moment of it, and had to measure how funny should it be, you know, because they're basically comedy writers, but I didn't want to do a straight ahead comedy, you know.
Right.
It had to be a little bit more of a dramedy, as it's called, you know, certainly with some humor, but you know, I didn't want anybody trying to be funny. You know, the humor had to come from circumstance. It had to come from the character. And so, you know, we had to keep an eye on that the whole time. And
yeah, that's tricky.
So, you know, yeah, it really was, you know.
Okay, cool. Because sometimes, you know, sometimes when a celebrity gets their name on something like that, they can negotiate for writing credit and producer credit. So I'm really happy to know that you were hands-on, you know, with dialogue and everything. That's cool. So excellent.
Yeah. I even directed the final episode.
Yep. See, that's amazing. You basically learned acting on the job, right? Because you were thrust into The Sopranos. Could you tell us how that came to be? How did little Steven go from rock and roller to actor?
It was just, one of those silly Hollywood stories of I was inducting the Rascals in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It happened to be the first time it was ever broadcast. The Hall of Fame used to be a private ceremony.
Right.
And David Chase, the creator of Sopranos, happened to be watching. Simple as that, you know, clicking around with the clicker, and he stopped on a channel that I was on and heard my little 3-minute intro and called up, said, you know, I want to have some new faces in this TV show I'm doing, you know, and I want you to be in it, you know. And I was like, man, well, I'd like to be in it, Dave, but I'm not an actor, man, you know. Sorry, you know,
right.
And he was like, no, you're an actor. You just don't know it yet. You know, so I went down there and, and we ended up doing it, you know.
How nervous are you the first day of shooting? You were with, you know, all these heavyweights in acting,
yeah.
David Chase.
Yeah, it was a trip. It was a trip. But I had written a bio of my character, you know, and I had created a character from the outside in. So, I felt if I could look in the mirror and see this guy, then I could be this guy. And in the bio, the guy was fearless. So, I basically came out of the trailer looking like that guy. And and so I acted like that guy. And I was, you know, because I couldn't have done it, you know, as little Steven, you know, I couldn't have done it looking like me, but as long as, you know, but being this other guy, you know, I just assumed another character and that character had no fear. So that's how we did it. You know?
So you build this from the outside in, and then once you get the costume and the wig on and everything, you're the guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't fuck with him, you know, because he's a dangerous guy.
That's right. You know? So you just continue to get offered little acting things here and there. You were in The Irishman. You played Jerry Vale.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a thrill to, a lifelong dream to work with Scorsese. You know, we run into each other every couple of years. And, and it was just one of those things that I loved the book when it came out. I didn't know he was going to do the movie. So
right.
it turned out to be one of my favorite mob books I've ever read. So I said to everybody, you know, I said to my agents and everybody, I said, you know, if I'm ever in one movie, I want it to be this one, you know. And at the last minute, most of the big parts were taken
right
by terrific, terrific actors. Every great actor in the world is in
Yeah, some
stage.
Guys we've heard of before, I think.
So, you know, the one thing left, you know, was Jerry Vale, who, if he lived, you know, he would have been in it. He would have been in it, of course, himself. But
right.
So I was able to do that. Just that little cameo, even that few seconds on screen was a thrill for me, and I was happy to do it. You know.
Well, I was excited when I saw it because I was like, wait a minute. Hold on a second. I know who that guy is. So very cool. I loved it. One more thing about acting compared to you didn't know you were going to talk about acting this much, probably, Stephen.
Oh, I don't care. I don't talk about anything you want, man. I got no agenda.
What gives you more of a thrill, stepping on to a soundstage for the first day of filming or stepping on to the stage to do a rock and roll show?
Well, but, you know, both those things are fun. You know, performing is fun, and it's what the audience, you know, knows you as, you know.
Yeah.
But for me, those things are like icing on the cake, and they're not really the cake for me. For me, my identity is really as a writer producer. You know, that's how I see myself, you know? So that's the stuff I get off on. I get off on, you know, writing songs, writing TV, creating events, you know. I wrote a Broadway show that we did, you know, producing TV, producing movies, producing, you know, whatever, creating the creative part, yeah. You know, the creating something from nothing is what I get off on the most. So, you know, when you get a chance to perform, it's kind of a vacation for me. You know what I mean? That's kind of the easy part of life. Yeah. You just, you know, you the work's already done in a way, you know, you just gotta, you know, bring it to life and get into whatever that character may be, whether it's a rock star or a gangster. You find that part of yourself that is that, you know, because we're all rock stars and gangsters inside, right. You know, so you find that whatever's appropriate for that particular gig, and you be that, you know. But, you know, anytime I don't have to think, man, that's a vacation. And so, you know, I enjoy both things.
You obviously had the rock and roll dream since you were a kid. When did you pivot and get this second career, decide that, hey, I'd like to really do some of these other things in film and TV?
Never. I never really. I had ideas for the record company when we started. You know, I wanted that to evolve into B movies. I've always wanted to bring back B movies. Mm-hmm. You know, Roger Corman's a hero of mine, and I wanted to bring back that kind of thing, and basically bring back beach movies and biker movies, and put the bands in the movies that are on the record, you know, on the record label. You know, never got around to doing that, unfortunately. And Robert Rodriguez has been doing a great job with that whole B movie kind of sensibility. You know, he's a genius, I think. But so that was the closest I've come to actually having any ambition in the film, you know, world. Really, I never had any ambition to act at all. So when David Chase called me, it was a brand new idea that I was just like, let's give it a shot, you know.
That's kind of cool because you get deep in a career and you think it's going to be one thing, and now it's tons of things. That's congratulations. Yeah. That's really cool.
I think that's true about life in general. You know, yeah. you get really good at one thing, and I think the world opens up for you. You know,
yeah, very nice. Well, congratulations on that success. Also, Wicked Cool Records. That's your record label. And yes. last year, they were nice enough to send me all of these. These are excellent.
All right.
These are great. You did an excellent job putting your music back out there.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we finally got it remastered first time ever.
Yeah.
With the Rock and Roll Rebel Box. And I've had the most productive 3 years of my life. I mean, leading up to the quarantine, you know, honestly, I've done a lot of things in my life, but this past 3 years, I did, you know, two tours, Soul Fire tour, Summer Sorcery tour, and six album packages, six. You know, we got a seventh one coming in July, the Summer Sorcery live DVD box, you know. So, you know, that's about as much as you can do, man. You know, I finally got the Lilyhammer score out, you know, because I'd done a score for Lilyhammer and that had never really been released. So I got that out, got the old stuff remastered. Two new records, you know, this new, Mac and the Mecca, which is it's part of the Soulfire box now, but if people who have the Soulfire box can get this thing separately, it's a Beatles tribute that we did as part of the Soulfire tour, you know. But that was it was just a wonderful 3 years and, you know, good timing because I got that done right before the quarantine hit. And we even got a new E Street Band record done.
Yeah, just before. Later. Yep, you know, letter to you. It's fantastic.
These crowd of mango trees I pulled at by some thread. Got down on my knees, grabbed my pen and bowed my head. Tried to summon all that my heart finds true and send it in my letter to you.
Yeah, that's waiting to be toured, hopefully someday. You know, so a lot of good work got done in those in that leading up to the quarantine. So I didn't mind being home for a year, man. You know,
no.
Okay with me.
Yeah. Look, a lot of times people are like, I don't have time to do all these things on my list. You have been checking things off your list constantly. Terrific.
Yeah. And it's been busier than ever. I mean, you know, the first few weeks of the quarantine were nice because, you know,
yeah,
everybody was in like a state of shock, you know, right. You know, but then soon, you know, you start doing lots of things and not just writing a book, but my record company, you know, I don't know how many artists just got signed now, must have a dozen. So they're sending me demos all the time, you know, check out songs, check out mixes, you know, check out, you know, the recording. You know, we got the music history curriculum online, which was really good timing to have it online.
Yeah.
Because the teachers were able to use that. Yeah. We got over 250 lessons online and it's all free for teachers. So they've been using that, you know, over 40,000 teachers have registered. So that was good timing to have that thing online. Most of my DJs of both my stations on Sirius Satellite actually work from home already, so we didn't have to make many changes for the quarantine.
Yeah, not too much of a pivot.
But you had to make some, you know. So we had to take care of some of that. And the radio, of course, with the radio show every week, you know, I got to listen to lots of records because we pick one coolest song in the world this week every week. And, you know, so there was plenty to do. You know, it got very busy very quickly.
Who are a couple of the new artists coming out on Wicked Cool Records that we should pay attention to? I mean, we should pay attention to all of them, but who's really got you excited?
You know, we got so many. I hate to, you know.
Okay, I understand. I get it. It's like,
I'm trying to think of the new stuff that's coming. Cocktail Slippers have a new album coming that's going to be really excellent. We just released Mark Ribbler's new album. He's my music director from the Disciples of Soul.
Okay.
And he's been writing and recording for years, but I think this album is finally, you know, really captures his talent. So Mark Ribbler's new one, Cocktail Slippers, is coming. What's out right now? I think Jesse Malin may have a new one out.
I love Jesse. He's been on the show. I love him.
Yeah, and he's doing great. We actually got him on the charts last year. I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, the real charts, like the real, like Billboard.
That's when you know that you're doing your job. The record label's doing its job if it gets the guy in the chart.
It was scary, man. It was freaky, you know. Who else? I don't know. We got so many great artists. We really do. You know, Ryan Hamilton and the Harlequin Ghosts. I don't know. So many. We got, you know, there's a lot. There's a lot happening.
We talked a little bit about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame earlier because that's where David Chase saw you. You finally got inducted, class of 2014, as a member of the E Street Band. How exciting was that for you?
Well, it's nice, you know, because you know, I really do respect the institution you know, I'm on the nominating committee, so I know how hard it is to get in, and it's hard to get in. There's a lot of a long line of very deserving artists waiting to get in. So it was a thrill, you know, to be in there with, you know, a lot of my heroes, and, you know, it's nice.
Let me ask you, this might be another one of those tough questions. If you were given a golden ticket, with that golden ticket, you can put someone in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame right now. Who do you think is the most deserving in your wheelhouse, things that you like, who would you put in there?
Oh, man. I would have to say it would be the Jay Giles Band. You know,
That's a good choice.
I just think they're one of the greatest live bands in history. Peter Wolf continues to be one of the great frontmen of all time.
Yep.
Trick now, you know I want it. I want it so bad. You know I need it. I can't believe it. So come on, baby, please relieve it. Got to give it to me. You got to give it to me.
You know, they did 10 or 11 or 12 just solid rocking albums, keeping the blues alive. Yeah. You know, they picked up, you know, they kind of picked up the blues flag, you know, from Paul Butterfield Blues Band, you know. And there weren't many people playing blues in those days, keep in mind. You know, we had, you know, Butterfield here, we had John Mayall in England, who also deserves to be in. And then the Jay Giles Band really was one of the few, you know, playing, you know, blues slash rock, you know, and soul, you know, mixing those things together. Yeah. But if I had, you know, if I could put one band in right now, it would be them.
Wow, that's a great, that choice did not disappoint. That's fantastic. That's a great one. Have they been on the ballot yet?
Well, they've been in and out. Yeah, they've, off and on. And, you know, we'll get them in eventually because they're just too good and too classic, you know. But it's tough. It's tough to get in. Like I said, it's a long line.
Oh, it's tough.
You know, we only get 5 or 6 every year, you know, and it's tough. It's tough to get in.
I want to go way, way back now to 1976 with your work with Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes.
Sweeter than honey.
You were their manager, producer, and kind of the chief songwriter for that band.
Yeah, yeah.
At a young age.
Me and Johnny, well, yeah, it was the first thing. It was the first real entry into the business, you know, for me. You know, first thing I produced. Me and Johnny started the band, and so we were kind of like. We're treating it like the white Sam and Dave. You know, we were kind of two lead singers at first, and then once I joined up with Bruce, you know, I wanted to get them a record deal and kind of start to separate myself from the band,
right?
You know, a little bit. Although, you know, I kept, you know, I did 3 albums with them. And, you know, sang some harmony on those records and played a few solos and wrote most of the stuff on those first 3 albums that were originals.
Yeah.
And then took a break. And then we did a reunion record years later in the early 90s called Better Days, which was one of the best ones.
You, Johnny, and Bruce sing a song together on that album.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I wrote a song about us being in Asbury Park in the late 60s. And yeah, very, very proud of that, actually.
We lived in a time in a world of our own, making up the rules as we went along. Just one coat between us and we
never felt cold. We were never gonna get old.
Like the cars till the sun came up, rolling dice. Down in the club, listening to the blues all night.
Girls out on the corner got lonely now and then.
We never.
But yeah, that was the first time I entered the business. That was the first song I ever wrote that I liked was I Don't Want to Go Home, which was the first song on the album and the name of the album.
Oh, I know that it's getting late, but I don't want to go home. I'm in no hurry, baby, time can wait, because I don't want to go to the man sing his song, but I don't wanna go home. I don't mind if it takes all night long, cause I don't wanna go home. Listen, baby, I know we've had a time, reach up and touch the sky, baby. Whatever happened to you and I?
Ronnie Spector's on that first album too.
Yeah. I had just come off what they call the oldie circuit, okay, which was a very bizarre moment in time. Around 1973, there suddenly was a rush of nostalgia about the 50s and early 60s, and it was a tragic story, really, because the British invasion that came in 64, you know, Beatles, Stones, Who, Kinks, Yardbirds, all of those groups that came in that first year and a half of the British invasion had the unintended consequence of putting all of their heroes out of work. So all the pioneers of rock and roll, suddenly in their prime of their lives, some of them, you know, in their 30s, early 40s, were suddenly put out to pasture. You know, it was just a real unfortunate moment in our history, you know, and they were relegated to this thing called the oldies circuit, even though they're in their 30s, you know. Yeah. Suddenly they're old, you know, and they hated that term, you know. Anyway, I ended up doing it just by circumstance. Long story, it's in the book, you'll read it later.
Okay, cool.
But basically I ended up being the backup band for a group called the Dovells, and then later with Dion. So I got a chance to meet all these people, and they were just great. You know, they're a different level of quality. Okay, I mean, I could say that and generalize very comfortably. You know, the 50s guys and early 60s guys and ladies, just another level of quality. Okay, because they had to be. Things didn't get fixed in those days. You know, you sang it live, and you had to be in tune, and you had to sing the right thing, and you had to be great every single time, you know. And so, as soon as I got in the studio, I felt like, you know, I want to remind people. I want to show some gratitude first of all to these pioneers, but also I want to show people that they're still great, you know, and they shouldn't be just, you know, tossed away. So yeah, we got Ronnie Spector out of retirement, and we got Lee Dorsey out of retirement. For the second album, this time it's for real, we reunited the Coasters.
After the music had stopped, I still heard it ring. I moved a little closer to hear the words she would say. She said, I'll never break your heart, I'll never try to fake it. My love is here for my little girl, so fine. The night seemed to say it was right, but could I believe her? My heart said it's time to go, but my heart.
And then, you know, I mean, Bruce would bring back Gary U.S. Bonds later. And I just did the first album for Darlene Love. You know, her first hit was He's a Rebel. That's her number one record, singing with the Crystal, 1962, I believe. Just did her first album a few years ago. So, you know, at the age of 73, we did Introducing Darlene Love, which is, you know, she's phenomenal still. She's absolutely phenomenal. The greatest, I think, the greatest singer in the world. You know, so I you know, every opportunity I got, you know, I would try and remind people that these pioneers are still around and they're still great, you know, and hire them. And you know, they give a very entertaining show, you know, because they're real pros, you know. And so, you know, that was the whole idea. And Southside agreed with that. And we had a terrific record company guy, a very unique man named Steve Popovich, who also went along with these crazy ideas that no one else on earth would have gone along with. So,
yeah, because in, you know, 76, 77, you guys want to bring the Satins in. I mean, a lot of record companies would be like, what are we doing here? I thought we were making, you know,
exactly
some current rock and roll.
Yeah. I mean, it was a weird thing to do. And we do a doo-wop song on This Time It's For Real called First Night. You know, thank God we had, you know, Steve Popovich was just one of those crazy cats that, you know, destiny, you know, led us to. Bruce introduced me to him and said, he's the guy for you. And man, he was so right. You know, we miss him. We miss him a lot.
Well, I wanted to ask about these artists because I know that you love that music and it must have been a kick for you to work with them and to get them work and to bring them back, you know, to the mainstream.
Definitely. And you know, I the biggest surprise for me was Gary U.S. Bonds, because Bruce had that idea, you know, and I'm looking at all the great singers that are still around. I'm like, you know, Wilson Pickett and Benny King, and, you know, and I'm like, you sure Gary U.S. Bonds, you know, I didn't really understand that, you know, because, you know, his records were great, but they're party records, and
right.
You know, it's not like it literally made in the garage, you know. And man, was I fooled. We got in the studio with Gary U.S. Bonds, turns out to be one of the greatest soul singers of all time, man. And we made the first album and actually had a hit from it, which was incredible.
Did she come walking down the street? You know, you better stay in line. This little girl.
And then we made a second album with him, which very few people have ever heard. We got to make sure that those things get re-released and remastered and everything. But the second album, Bruce wrote practically the entire album. It's all like Bruce Springsteen songs.
It's incredible.
And it's one of my favorite productions I've ever done. It's just a great, great, great album that very few people heard. 2 albums with Gary, and I even did a track for a third album that Gus started called Standing in the Line of Fire. But he had a whole second career from that, which was great.
The only reason I know of Gary U.S. Bonds is because of the work that you guys did with him. You know, I was late teens when those records came out that you guys did. So thank you. It's always great to be introduced to these. I mean, there's so much music. You know what I mean? It's not possible to know it all, but when you do find something that you know and you love, it's great. It's like a gift.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Let me talk about some Bruce era stuff. Was Darkness on the Edge of Town, was that like the first album that you were fully involved with Bruce?
Yes, I visited the Born to Run sessions.
Yeah,
just as a friend hanging out. But yeah, Darkness was the first. Yes, I did full time.
And then after that, The River. And then after that, Bruce does Nebraska. And then this is where you do your first proper solo album, Men Without Women.
Yeah, I actually did 2 albums. I became co-producer on The River, mm-hmm. and co-produced Born in the USA.
Right.
And then they took like a break, and I forget how many songs are on there, 11 or 12 songs on there. I did 9 or 10 of them. Let me see. No, I must have done 9 of the 12, if there's 12. And then they took a little break, and I did two entire albums.
Yes.
And 2 tours, you know, and came back, and they had added 3 songs to Born in the USA. They took, you know, 2 of my tours and 2 of my albums, and they added 3 more songs. And
in the time that you did all that, they did 3 songs, is what you're saying.
Okay. Yes. But they were good ones.
Yeah, they were good ones.
We were the wildest things we'd ever seen. And I wish you
Now, I can remember seeing, I think, Forever, the video for Forever on MTV, and I immediately loved it. It was so, the band looks so cool. Who's, I don't know how to say his name, the Mohawk guy from the
Jean Beauvoir.
I mean, you see that guy, he's rock and roll immediately as soon as you see him. And yeah, I just love Men Without Women. So had you been writing songs and holding them though for yourself for possible student? No,
no. Again, just like my acting career, you know, I was not planning on a solo career either.
Okay.
Yeah, my life is weird, man. You know, I mean, the more you think about it, you know, my life always comes through the side door. You know, I don't know why that is. Is this my destiny? But a guy named Gary Gersh, who was, actually the guy who signed Gary U.S. Bonds to EMI America, which was a new label for EMI. He said, you know, why don't you do a solo record? You know, which I never really had any thoughts of doing.
Yeah,
and. So I kind of got into it and did that and that first album, you know, and one thing led to another and you know, became five albums in the '80s.
Yeah, and this first album has such great songs on. Lying in the Bed of Fire is terrific.
Yeah, thank you. I had gotten into, you know, politics, you know, just accidentally again, like most of my life. And I wanted to open the album. I knew the first album had to be more of an introduction to me as now a solo performer, as opposed to a sideman, which is a different persona, a different character, you know, a different movie, you know.
Right.
So I changed, you know, the name changed to Little Steven, and just to separate the two things, and I knew I had to identify myself on that first album, which I mostly did. It's more of a personal album. I was about to get married to my wife, so a lot of the album's about Maureen, but I decided I would open the album with a song that was going to be my real mission if I continued making records.
Gotcha.
Which was going to be in a political vein, you know. So that first song, Lying in the Bed of Fire, talks about basically the theme that would run through most of my five albums in the 80s, which was, you know, what happened to all the ideals of the 60s. We all talked about, you know, what happened, you know, we were going to change the world. What happened? Yeah. Where, you know, where'd those ideals go? Where'd all those great ideas and a wonderful passion and emotions and grandiose sort of, you know, fantasies about a brand new world, man. You know, what happened? So that, you know, that was that asked that question. And of course, the next four albums would be very specifically political.
And to use your creative voice, you know, to get thoughts and ideas out there, it's just as important as just making, you know, fun rock and roll albums. I mean, it's probably more important.
Well, at the time, you know, growing up in the Renaissance, and I call that period the Renaissance, you know, from, I don't know, around 20, 25 years from the early 50s to the mid 70s, you know, it really was a Renaissance period. And you had to have a very specific, unique identity, so I thought, you know, the world doesn't need love songs from a sideman, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I got into politics. Maybe I'll be the political guy. You know, that'll right. be my identity. You know, there were a lot of musicians getting involved in issues as far as protest, you know, and doing concerts for various issues. You know, Jackson Brown did everything, man.
Yeah,
you know, Bonnie Raitt, Graham Nash, and John Hall, and you know, these cats. You know, I could never work as hard as they work. But very few people and very few songs actually were capturing that kind of subject matter. You know, you'd have one every now and then. You know, you'd have Buffalo Springfield, For What It's right. Worth, you know, Steve sure. Stills. You'd have Volunteers of America from Jefferson Airplane, you know.
But you're going back to the 60s for these songs.
Right. And the ultimate, you know, I mean, Bob Dylan, you know, kind of introduced the whole idea of political consciousness into the pop idiom, you know. And then you had the most notable, of course, was Neil Young's Ohio with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, those were one-offs here and there. You know, I mean, you'd have a song here, a song there.
Yeah.
And I decided, you know, I'm going to do it full time.
Leaned into
nothing but politics and be very extreme about it, with the thought of making it a regular, normal part of our business rather than something that has to be a special event, a special concert for an issue. I was like, you know, we should be engaged in things all the time, you know, and you know, it doesn't have to be full time like me, you don't have to be extremist like me, but you know, let's make it okay for young groups to see what's possible with this art form. You know, let's take this art form out for out for a spin. Let's see what we can do with it, you know.
Yeah. And EMI America, they were on board with it, obviously.
Well, yeah, they I laughed because, you know, I didn't ask them and I'm not sure they got what they expected, to be honest. I mean,
okay.
I mean, the first album was okay. I'm not sure they were expecting what I gave them, you know, because I was making it up as I went along and I didn't really discuss it with anybody.
Yeah.
You know, so they might have been a little bit surprised thinking they're gonna, you know, they signed this very fun, you know, the E Street Band was the rock and roll Rat Pack, and I'm Dean Martin, man. So you know, they sign this fun guy, and suddenly he's getting all serious, and you know, what is all this politics stuff? You know, so I'm sure they were not thrilled in the boardroom. I'm guessing, but they tolerated me at least for one more record. And then I had to look elsewhere for my third record. But I don't think they were that thrilled about it, to be honest. Right. They were cool. They were cool enough.
Voice of America is fantastic. You dropped the Disciples of Soul, though, on that album. Name.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, you know, I probably shouldn't have done that. Probably just confusing, but I started to wander away from soul music. I dropped the horns at that point, you know, and it was the beginning of, you know, and I look back, believe me, I look back and I question whether I did the right thing or not, but it was the beginning of me having the sound and music on every album directly related to the theme of that record,
yeah.
You know, rather than having a career per se where you have one identity and that's who you are, you know, which would have made much more sense. And I might have even had a career had I done that, you know. Every single one of my albums of the 80s is completely different musically,
yes,
because they are the soundtrack to a different movie, each one, you know? I thought, well, Soul, you know, Disciples of Soul, even though it would have made sense to keep it, and I should have probably kept the name at least, but I thought, since I'm letting the horns go, you know, maybe I'll let the soul part of the name go, which I probably shouldn't have done that, because that was made it even more confusing, you know?
Yeah.
But at that point, I wanted to do something harder edged. I wanted to start making, you know, more of a rock records. And, the subject matter wanted something a little bit tougher, you know?
Gotcha. So Voice of America comes out in May of 84. And then Born in the USA comes out in June of 84. And you decide not to go on the tour for Born in the USA. How did that decision come about?
Yeah, that was business genius going on right there. first of all, I don't know how I missed this information, but I didn't know that Bruce was going to call it Born in the USA. So I come out with Voice of America with all this, you know, American flags everywhere,
and, right.
You know, red, white, and blue. And then he comes out with the same thing 3 months later, you know. So my album was immediately dead on arrival, because people were like, why should we play the sideman's record when we can play the real guy's record, yeah, you know, the main guy, you know. So nobody ever heard that Voice of America record, but it was just funny. You know, came out right on top of it, and with the same marketing, red, white, and blue, and American flags. Yeah. And, you know, even you know. Anyway, I decided to pursue what I was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, I kind of had awakened the artist in me, which. You know, had been pretty dormant. I mean, you know, other than the songwriter part of that, which I had been exercising through the Jukes, you know, just I thought I felt it was time to, you know, to become to fully embrace the artist part of myself. You know.
So was it an easy decision or a difficult decision to not tour with the E Street Band for that run?
Very difficult. And looking back, I wish I could have stayed and accomplished what I accomplished by leaving. You know, I wish I could have done both things. Because everything I accomplished and everything I know in the world, I learned after I left the E Street Band.
Yeah.
But, you know, looking back, you know, I wish I could have found a way to do both things, which is probably unrealistic, of course. But it's a very difficult decision. And one I question, you know, about every 2-3 hours.
Well, you're back now, so all is good. But at the time, what was Bruce's reaction? Was he upset? Did he try to talk you into staying?
Yeah, it was disappointing, you know, because you know we felt like we were just on the verge of something really big. I mean, we had broken through with the river, which was a major,
yeah,
the most important thing was breaking through finally. Our fifth album, it took 5 albums.
It's crazy,
you know, and you know, but now there was momentum, you know, for this next one that was going to be even bigger, you know. So we were best friends, and you know, Bruce wanted me to share, you know, share that experience with,
yeah,
him, you know.
Sure.
And so he was very disappointed that I left, and you know, and I, you know, like I say, I regret leaving. And I wish I could have figured out a way to do both.
Yeah. They found a great, not a replacement, but Nils comes in. He does great. And then when you come back, now the fans get all 3 guitarists. We get you, Bruce, and Nils, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, well, I was replaced by 2 people. You know, Nils for the guitar and Patty Scalfa for the vocals.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Apologies to Patty. Yeah, no, because you know, she comes and goes when she can, because you know she's got other responsibilities these days with the kids and stuff. But it was you know, so yeah, it became a bigger band, and then I came back in, and you know, my role, it wasn't so much important. It wasn't so important as the guitar player, mm-hmm, or singer. You know, really, my role really is the best friend, you know, Bruce Springsteen. You know, and I that is something that you can't replace. You know what I mean? You can't,
yeah,
really replace that, and you can't really, you know, it's one of those things that makes us a band.
Yeah.
You know, when you got somebody who you've known your whole life standing next to you, you know, it feels more real. It's more of a real experience than something that, you know, you've grown into. So you know, it was important, I think, to come back for that kind of closure for us, and to continue, you know, seeing what we can do. I mean, this new album we just did, man, you know,
it's amazing.
This ain't no joke.
Like you said, you know, those songs need to be played live.
Yeah.
They're begging to be played live.
I hear the sound of your guitar.
When you came back to the band, there was like, it's a comfort knowing that the foundation is still intact. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. There's the four. You got the four originals. You know, still me, Gary, Max, and Roy. You know, yeah. You know, four out of you know, and five counting Bruce, of course. But five out of the original seven. You know, we lost Clarence and Danny along the way. But yeah, so we still have a rock solid connection to the original band for sure. I mean, it was a tricky, you know, tricky moment. You know, figuring out how to continue, you know, especially with Clarence, you know, but Jake really was a godsend and really helped make that transition. You know,
because he's family. He's, you know, in many ways.
And that blood connection was very important at that moment. You know, so that was the way we were able to keep it. E Street Band, because without him, you know, maybe it would have morphed into something else. It would have morphed into some other, you know.
The audience immediately accepted Jake because his last name is Clemens. I mean, it's true. But I mean, he obviously has to be great, but immediately people are like, this is how it should be. This makes sense.
Yeah. I tell the whole story in the book because it's a tricky, very tricky moment. A very, very tricky moment. And we, you know, we had to really spend some time thinking about it and talking about it because, you know, things are not inevitable. You know, you don't just continue automatically. You know, these things need to be figured out.
How often when you're playing live with the E Street Band in the present, do you feel Danny or Clarence there? Are they always there in some way?
Yeah, they really are. I mean, you know, I'll look over sometimes, you know, and I love Charlie, you know.
Yeah.
I really do. He turned out to be just perfect and terrific. You know, but I'll expect to see Danny sometimes, you know, or Clarence and you know, and you have to remember, oh yeah, you know. But their spirit is very, very much there with us. We salute them every night.
That's right. I was assuming that would be the way because they're just embedded in the music. They're there.
Yeah, that's right. It lives on. They live on. You know, both very unique. You know, neither one of those guys. You don't replace guys like that. You know,
right.
You become something different.
You soldier on. You know, and
we have enough identifiable elements to continue to call it the E Street Band.
Right.
But it's a different E Street Band. It is a different E Street Band. You know.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I want to talk about 1989's album, Revolution. This is the one in your catalog, to me, that really takes a left turn musically. It almost sounds like your version of a Prince album, maybe. It's just different for me. If I can be honest, it's not my favorite in the Little Steven catalog.
Yeah, no, you're not alone. It was confusing for people. I was heading there in that direction, a little bit subtly, but the album before that, Freedom No Compromise, and also the experimenting I was doing on the Sun City album.
Yes.
I'd been getting into the drum machine and electronic bass stuff. So you already had two albums before that, beginning that process of combining rock with dance music. And I just felt at that moment, I wanted to experiment and the theme of that record was about alienation, and I wanted it to be the only human element on the album. I wanted it to be the voice, you know.
Okay.
I wanted it to be very mechanical, you know, very mechanized, very technological, because that was the theme of the album. But yeah, it wasn't a whole lot of rock on there. I mean, there's a couple of solos, obviously a couple of rock, you know, rock guitar solos, but mostly it's funk. It's really deep,
it really is heavy funk.
You know, and there's a little bit of Prince in there. There's George Clinton in there. There's a lot of Sly and the Family Stone in there. A lot of funk going on at the time.
Yeah,
you know, and I was totally into it. You know, I was just like, you know, I'm not going to be afraid of this technology. Let me jump into it and see what happens. You know, I was not thinking clearly, in terms of a career, you know, because, it was very confusing for the fans. You know, you're not the only one. I mean, people, you know, are just starting to get into it now because it sounds like Bruno Mars' next album, you know, you know, it's actually quite a high quality album. It's just not rock and roll, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, if you kind of go into it with a different head frame of mind, you know, if you put Bruno Mars' name on the album, people would love it, you know. But because it was me, you know, and I had this, they had this rock identity, which was really a leftover from the association with the E Street Band, you know, mostly, you know, people were a little confused by it, but, you know, when given a chance, you know, people are, you know, looking at it differently now, and they're starting to get into it now. But, I took that as far as I could take it, and I got that, you know, kind of just, it just kind of left my system after that. And I came back and did three albums that same year. I mean, I did the Revolution tour. Then I came back and wrote Born Again Savage, and this other album called The Lost Boys, which has never come out. I'll get that out one of these days. That's the only thing that's left on the shelf.
Well, let's talk about Born Again Savage, because it's like a power trio. You have quite a rhythm section on this album. You got Adam Clayton from U2 and Jason Bonham from everywhere. He's just played on so many things. How did you get these guys involved?
Yeah. I just, you know, like I said, I kind of got the whole modern world technology thing. It just kind of left my system after Revolution. And suddenly I really, you know, and through the years, you know, once you start becoming a front man, you start to, you know, your identity changes in your head. And so I was playing less and less guitar as the decade went on, you know? So by Revolution, I'm not playing hardly at all, you know? And so suddenly I had a real urge to play guitar again. And I made two completely guitar records with no keyboards, and including Born Against Savage, which was like a 60s, I wanted to make a 60s hard rock record because I love that whole 60s hard rock thing from, you know, Cream and Jeff Beck Group and Jimi Hendrix Experience and you know, early Led Zeppelin and Bad Company and The Who and The Kinks, you know. So I wanted to make that album, and I demoed it and put it on the shelf, and we were doing a residency at a place called the Cat Club in Manhattan. It's no longer there. I had done a record with Michael Monroe, and we formed a new a neo-punk band called Demolition 23.
Is that Michael Monroe from Hanoi Rocks?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. I got to re-release that record this year. It's a terrific album. It's real punky, really traditional punk. It's like a real Ramones and Pistols kind of
nice.
Punk.
Perfect.
And it's one of my favorite records I've ever done. And of course, we took it around the record companies, and they said punk is over. You know, and then like 3 years later, here comes Green Day and Offspring and all these modern punk, you know, groups. Anyway. We gotta get that back out.
Born in the age of Alta Monta. Mommy was a hippie and daddy was a drunk. They really believed all you need is love. Well, they were looking for God, the streets were running with blood. Now there ain't no one to trust. You're a sex stage baby.
But we're doing a residency, and Adam Clayton, you know, walks in one night, and we're just talking. He's like, "What do you got?" I said, "Hey, you know, I got some things, you know, including this rock record I've done. I put it on the shelf. I don't really know what to do with it." And he says, "Well, I got a couple of weeks off. You know, let's go make the record."
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, it was literally Adam Clayton's enthusiasm that got that record made. And we were like, well, you know, who'd be the perfect drummer? And I'm like, well, it's a real 60s hard rock record. So, you know, I bet you, John Bonham's son, Jason, would really understand this stuff. You know?
Perfect.
And we just, I just called him out of the blue, found him, and he was into it. You know, I never had met him before. You know, Adam I knew, So he came in and we knocked it off in about a week.
We are the chosen ones, that's what they told me. We got the power, the money, the guns. If there's a God, he is waiting on our side. You'll believe anything when you are young. We are the civilized, they always told me. Organized, I was told. I found it more honest, exploring the darkness. Cause Jesus never wore no South African gold. Look around, baby, we're desperate, divided. All calling God by different names. Nearly
you three played live in the studio together.
Well, I had them replace the parts. You know,
okay.
We did some things that way, but a lot of it was replacing the parts I had. You know?
Okay. Well, I mean, this album, it kicks ass. I mean, Guns, Drugs, and Gasoline. I mean, this is a. I love this record so much, and it's so different from Revolution. It's like you do a little bit of everything. It's pretty cool.
I know. I am pretty schizophrenic. It's true. I don't do it lightly. I mean, you know, when I make a funk record, it's going to be all the way funk, you know, and when I make a rock record, it's going to be all the way rock. It just so happened, you know, like I said, the technology, the modern technology thing just went out of my system with that Revolution record. I was done. I was like, you know, I'm going back to the beginning here. And Born Again Savage popped out, you know.
I want to just mention the two most previous albums then, 2017 Soul Fire, excellent. And you finally got to do your version of Love in the Wrong Side of Town, and it's terrific. I really like it.
Thank you.
You and Bruce wrote that together, so cool.
Yes.
And then 2019 Summer of Sorcery, you put the Disciples of Soul name back on the records, on this record. And it's
we returned to the original sound, and you know, basic instrumentation of my first solo album. So yeah, Disciples of Soul made a return here.
Yes, they did.
And then I added the harmony, which I never had harmony. But when I did the Darlene Love albums, you know, she had three backup singers that were just terrific. And I fell in love with figuring out harmony parts, you know, because I love the whole jigsaw puzzle of production. Arranging is my favorite part of it. And so I already got the horns and strings. And now, you know, you add the harmony parts and figuring out, you know, where those things fit together and so they don't step on each other and, you know, used to their most maximum effectiveness. It's just nothing but fun for me. I just love that. So I added that final element of harmony with the three girls. And that's how you get a 14-piece band, you know.
Well, I appreciate your enthusiasm for what you do after all these years. You're not ready to retire. There's no retirement in your future.
No. Just getting started, man. This is a whole new rebirth.
You mentioned your wife Maureen earlier. You've been married the whole time since this is it.
82.
Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah. That's not easy.
No, she's a saint. She's She's I don't know how she tolerates me, but it's miraculous, you know.
And you guys are staying safe. Have you been vaccinated yet?
Yeah. We're safe. You know, we're still playing it safe, even though we're vaccinated. I mean, it's just a scary moment, you know, and you can see what's happening in India. You know, they were completely disease free. They thought they were done.
Yeah.
You know, and then boom, you know, it comes out of nowhere and they're just really in big trouble at the moment. So, you know, we'll see what the rest of this year, hopefully the vaccinations will continue and these, you know, anti-vax people will come to their senses, I hope.
Yeah, chill out a little bit. And I told my wife today that for me, a mask is going to be optional clothing. Whenever I want to wear it, I'm going to wear it.
Yeah. I ain't never shaking anybody's hand again. That's over, you know. I mean, things like that.
How will that play into wanting fans who want to meet you in person and get autographs and stuff? What's going to happen?
We're just talking about that today. I mean, honestly, it's a very good question. And we're just talking about it today, figuring out some kind of way of doing a meet and greet that's going to be, you know, safe for everybody. Yeah. You know, you don't want to take pictures with masks on, you know.
Right, that's weird. So, you know,
I should have a picture like put onto a mask, right? So like
just have your mouth on the mask.
It's like your face, yeah.
A big smile. All right.
But certainly no more physical contact. That's best for sure.
Yeah, it's tough. Let me tell people where they can find you. Go to littlesteven.com. On Twitter, it's at Stevie Van Zandt. On Instagram, it's at Stevie Van Zandt. And for the Underground Garage on Twitter, it's at Little Steven _UG for Underground Garage, I believe.
Is that right?
I think so.
Not undergroundgarage.com?
I was given the Twitter. But yeah, undergroundgarage.com also. And the label's Wicked Cool Records. And I have to be honest, it lives up to the name. It's a wicked cool record label.
And we got lots of great talent. Lots of great talent. And you know, I put our record label against anybody's, honestly.
You guys are doing great work. I get press releases all the time from you guys, new artists all the time. And this is the place to get your back catalog, the best it sounds, and, you know, with DVDs and concerts and all kind of great stuff. So,
yeah.
Stephen, there's only one more question for you. I always end the show with a playout song. What song from your entire catalog would you like me to use as our playout song?
Wow. Well, since you brought up Born Again Savage, maybe something from that, huh? You want to go out with Guns, Drugs, and Gasoline? What do you think?
I don't think you can end the show better than that. So, Stephen, thank you for your time. You guys can follow us at Rock Solid Show and go to rocksolidpodcast.com for all things about the show. And everybody, please enjoy Guns, Drugs, and Gasoline. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, my friend.
you and Maureen stay safe and
see you soon. We'll do it again when the book comes out.
That would be great. Thank you, Stephen.
Yeah, I want you to read it first.
Well, I definitely will.